like a rock on the edge of the cliff. A feather could start it down. One night, I got into an argument with Yoktan, and Yok started at me with his fists. I looked up just in time. There was Samson reaching for Yok with those great arms of his. It was all I could do to stop him. Yuel whistled. I should think, he began, when a chiming gong interrupted him, and he rose to his feet. Father insists that we're on time for meals, he said. We'd better talk later. Near the fountain in the courtyard, Hezron stood waiting, a tall, narrow-faced man with graying hair. He bowed with a cool courtesy at Yuel's introduction.
Peace be with you, he said.
You are welcome. He gazed with distaste at Daniel's unlawful garment. A camel would be as welcome, Daniel thought. The man will have to purify his whole house when I leave. Side by side, two women moved gracefully across the tile pavement, Malthus and an older woman who must once have looked much like her daughter. A tiny bird of vivid blue darted from a dwarf pear tree and lighted for a breath space on the girl's shoulder, then flashed away. The corner of Thashia's face curled slightly as she looked at Daniel, hinting, I could tell them much if I cared. The mother smiled warmly and held out her hand to him. They led Daniel through an archway into a spacious room, his muscles stiffened at the array of couches. Was he expected to eat his meal lying down like a Roman? But after an awkward wait, he lowered his body gingerly and, imitating Yuel, propped himself up on one elbow, aware of Thashia's amusement. For all her airs, he could wager she had never seen a couch herself up to a month ago. No one in the village boasted such heathen nonsense. Yuel's mother, with a gracious word, led her daughter behind a silken screen, where they would both be hidden from view while the men of the family ate. More nonsense. Daniel was sure that in the village they must have sat on mats and eaten their meal together like any other family. Through the prolonged hand-washing, Daniel fidgeted, affronted by the silver pitchers, the fine tiny napkins, the hovering slaves. Then, at the sight of the food, a fierceness sprang up in him. He had drained every drop from the cup of date wine before he noticed that the others were holding theirs untouched. Too late, he set down what remained of his small loaf of bread. He had torn into it like Samson himself, and he saw Hezron's lips flatten together. Curse their finicky rules. Had they ever felt the gnawing of an empty stomach? Your home? Hezron inquired, after the scant portions of fish and fruit had been consumed in silence.
Is it far from Capernaum?
Daniel dragged his attention from his empty bowl. In Ketza, sir.
Indeed?
Hezron looked surprised.
Your father, too? I do not seem to recall.
My father was Yamin, chief overseer of the vineyards.
So, said Hezron, frowning. I remember. A very tragic affair. He was a good man, your father, but a rash one.
His cool tone pricked Daniel's thin skin and stirred the anger that always smoldered close under the surface. He glowered at his plate, holding his tongue.
You are the support of your mother?
My mother is not living either. Hezron hesitated.
You have been doubly unfortunate, he said in a kinder tone, mistaking Daniel's anger for grief. Do you follow your father's trade?
No, I was bound to Amalek, the ironsmith. Sold, he felt like shouting. Sold into slavery for a term of 6 years, to a man who is not fit to own even a mule. Had the rabbis protested then, or a single soul in the village lifted a finger to help him?
Well, said Hezron reasonably, it is necessary for every boy to learn a trade. Yuel, as you probably know, was trained as a sandal maker, as I was myself. Though I must say I applied myself with more diligence, I do not seem to remember seeing you in a Moloch's shop.
I didn't work there long. You can tell he's a blacksmith, Yuel broke in.
in an effort to swerve his father's questions. "With those muscles, you'd be a sensation in the gymnasium, Daniel. Have you ever been there?"
"The Roman gymnasium?"
Daniel glared at his friend. "I would never set foot in it."
"I should hope not," said Hezron, with a scowl at his own son.
That was an ill-considered jest.
"Of course it was a jest, father," Yoel amended hastily.
"It is not a matter for jesting," his father said. "It is an outrage that some of our Jewish youths have been tempted to take part in these disgraceful games. And some of their elders even go to watch their shame."
"Well, there are other things in the city worth seeing,"
Yoel persisted cheerfully.
"This afternoon, I'll take you about, Daniel."
Daniel stared down at his empty cup. The morsels of food had not begun to whet his hunger. The rabbi had deliberately put him at a disadvantage with every question. His resentment turned now even against Yoel.
"I have seen enough," he said rudely. "All I can see is the Roman fortress and the eagles in the streets. Everywhere I turn, I hear the ring of Roman boots on the pavement."
Yoel, a worried line puckering his forehead, still attempted to steer his friend to safety.
"I felt that way at first," he said, "but you do get used to it. For the most part, they mind their own business. Some of them even try to be friendly."
"Friendly?" Daniel reared up on his couch. "This morning, on the road, I passed an old man mending the axle of his wagon. He was deaf, and he couldn't hear the chariot coming. It caught his rear wheel. He said there was room and to spare. He swore the soldier meant to do it. His cabbages were ruined, and the old man was shaking all over. Can you get used to that?"
He glared across the table.
Yoel looked down, dismayed. Hezron spoke sternly.
"Unfortunate things happen, we know," he said. "But your friend has doubtless found a market for his vegetables. We must remember that here in Capernaum, we have reason to be grateful to the Romans for our beautiful synagogue."
But Daniel had gone too far to retreat. The dark tides had swelled to the brink, flooding out politeness, caution, even the memory of the errand that had brought him to this house.
"A Roman synagogue," he growled, "raised with Roman taxes. What is it better than the stadium?"
Yoel gasped. Hezron, his eyes flashing, rose from his couch.
"Watch your words, boy," he warned. "The synagogue is a house of God, no less because Roman funds helped to build it."
The boy also sprang to his feet. His dark eyes blazed back at the man.
"I would never set foot in it," he cried. "There is blood upon it."
The passion in his words trembled through the quiet room.
"Young man," Hezron's voice was like a whip, "you will learn to keep such thoughts to yourself. If you have no concern for your own life, you will respect the safety of those who offer you hospitality."
The stinging reminder restored Daniel to reason. A flush swept over his face.
"Forgive me, sir," he stammered. I was not ungrateful for your kindness. But I can't understand. Have the city people forgotten? They don't seem to care. Everywhere I look, I see them. Their stupid faces, their armor clanking. How can you feel grateful to them? Grateful that they built us a synagogue to keep us contented? That they let us breathe the air they have polluted?
I shouldn't have come here. I don't belong in the city or in a house like this. I can't endure to go on as though nothing were wrong when my people are prisoners on their own land."
He stammered to a stop, aghast at himself, and saw to his surprise that the man was no longer looking at him with scorn, but with something like pity. Hezron stepped around the table and laid a hand firmly on Daniel's shoulder.
"My boy," he said quietly, "we have not forgotten. We feel as you do. In his heart, every Jew grieves at our captivity. We have need of patriotism like yours, but we have need also of patience. We must not say we cannot endure what God, in his judgment,
has visited upon us. But how long must we endure it forever?
God has not spoken his final word. Until he does, it is our part to endure.
But
I know. You have been listening to the zealots. They stir up foolhardy young men like you to fill their ranks.
Daniel backed away, freeing his shoulder. The zealots are the finest men in Galilee. They are brave and honorable.
Hezron stopped him. Many brave men have come out of Galilee, he said, but not many men of judgment. The zealots have thrown themselves against the conquerors time and time again. And what have they to show for it? Rows of crosses and burning villages and heavier taxes. They see a few Romans marching, a cohort, and the Roman power seems slight and open to attack. They do not think that behind these few there are others, another cohort, a legion, countless legions, on and on, as far as the mind can reach, all armed, all perfected in the art of killing.
To a power that holds the whole world in its grip, what is a swarm of reckless zealots?
Buzzing mosquitoes to be silenced and forgotten.
They...
Mark my words, boy. Israel has one great strength, mightier than all the power of Rome. It is the law given to Moses and our fathers. When the last Roman emperor has vanished from the earth, the law will still endure. It is to the law that our loyalty must be devoted. I wish Yoel to understand this, and I must forbid him to see any old friends who will turn his mind to violence. I ask you to go now, at once. Go in peace, Daniel, with a prayer that you may see the truth before that rash tongue of yours betrays you. But do not return. He motioned to a servant who stood near the door. Go with our guest and see that he has started on the right road.
Yoel made an impulsive gesture, swiftly checked, and stood quietly. Thoroughly silenced, too confused even to attempt a courteous leave-taking, Daniel flung back his head and followed the servant from the room. As the outer door shut behind him, all his rage was turned against himself. How could he have bungled his errand so stupidly? He had failed Roche. Roche would never trust him again, and why should he? He could not even keep his own head. And he had lost Yoel. Yet beyond the humiliation of reporting his defeat to Roche, he knew a sharper disappointment. He had lost not only a new recruit, he had lost something he had been close to having for the first time in his life. A friend of his own.
6. The Bronze Bow. Daniel turned his face toward the mountain. He intended to leave the city and never set foot in it again. Instead, smarting from Hezron's dismissal, dreading to face Roche, smoldering with resentment against himself and the world, he blundered straight into trouble. At a crossroads, he came to a well, and seeing a broken bowl nearby, he went down on his knees to scoop up water. Before he could even cool his tongue, a shadow fell across his bent shoulders. He saw close beside him the dark, wet flanks of a horse, and looked straight up into the face of a Roman.
Water for the horse, boy,
the soldier ordered, not unpleasantly.
We have come a long way.
Daniel stiffened, but he noticed, against his will, the heaving sides of the overridden animal, the streaks of foam on the glossy neck. The beast, too, was helpless in the hands of the Roman. He could not deny it water. He lifted the bowl and held it steady while the animal quenched its thirst.
Enough! The Roman barked. You'll give him a swollen belly. Now some for me.
Daniel hesitated. Then, sullenly, he lifted the bowl toward the man. A vicious kick, missing its aim, sent a shower of drops through the air.
Impudent scum! The man roared. Fresh water!
Daniel's hatred brimmed over.
Without a thought, he hurled the contents of the bowl straight into the man's face. For the space of a breath, he stood paralyzed. Then his wits came back, and he ran. There was a shout behind him. A stunning blow against his ribs sent him staggering, and a spear clattered in the road just ahead of him. He regained his feet and ran on, ducked behind a stone wall, ran bent over under its shelter for a way, and then made a dash for a clump of trees. There was more shouting now, and the thud of feet. He dared not look back. He reached the trees and then a row of houses, saw an alleyway open before him, and fled along it. The feet pounded after him. At the end of the alley, he dodged one way and then another. He was running uphill now, and his breath was coming short. He stumbled, righted himself. He crawled over a low wall and crouched behind it to catch his breath, pressing hard against the pain in his ribs. His hands came away sticky and red. He saw that he was in a garden, and that opposite him, a ladder led up to the terrace above. He barely managed the ladder, but it gave him a moment's advantage. He could still hear the running feet, but he dared now to climb more slowly and conserve his breath. He gained the next terrace, and then the next. He stopped finally, gasping, and leaned against a terrace wall. He had outrun them. In the quiet orchard, there was no sound of pursuit. But he had used up almost all his strength. Pain gripped his whole chest now and ran down his arm into his fingers. Very soon, he would have to lie down and wait for them to find him. Where could he go? Down there in that huddle of houses, was there someone who might give him shelter? But Roche had warned them against trusting even their fellow Jews. Roman methods were too sure. Would any man hide a stranger, knowing what it might mean to his family? No, he must keep on the hill. The Romans would not be so likely to look up here. An icy fog kept drifting over his eyes. In panic, he realized that he was not even thinking clearly. He clung now to one chance, and he knew that that chance had been in his mind all along and had directed his feet even when he was running too fast to think. If he could get to Yoel, Yoel would take him in. He didn't know why he was sure of this, but on that first day on the mountain, he had trusted Yoel. He never remembered how he got to the door in the long wall, or how he had sense enough to pull the folds of his robe to cover the dark stain that spread down his side. Afterwards, he recalled that the doorman admitted him and went to summon Yoel. But as he stood for the second time in the outer hallway, he was not thinking at all, only concentrating on staying on his feet. Presently, he heard a step on the courtyard paving, and a figure approached him, wavering and indistinct against the light. Then his eyes focused, and he saw that once again it was not Yoel, but Malthus. She came toward him swiftly. "Daniel," she said, "you must go away quickly. Yoel is not here. He and Father have gone to the synagogue, but they may be back any moment." Daniel's wits moved slowly. He could not quite take in what she was saying, but he perceived that his one chance had failed. Still, he could not seem to move. "Don't you understand?" she said sharply. "If Father finds you here, he will have no patience. Why did you come back anyway?" He forced himself to one more attempt. "I must see Yoel," he said, his voice harsh. "It is important." "Nothing is so important as Yoel's studies," she flared. "If you cared anything about Yoel, you would leave him alone. He could be a famous rabbi someday. He's not going to risk his whole fortune for a band of outlaws." Daniel looked at her stupidly. Her voice seemed to be coming from farther and farther away. "Can't you see?" she cried. "Yoel is torn in two directions, but he knows what is right. Please, Daniel, I beg you, go away and leave him alone." Briefly, the mist cleared. He realized that once again he had blundered. The girl was right. He could only bring danger and trouble for Yoel. He turned away, saw the door wavering and dissolving in the wall, took two steps toward it, and plunged headlong into blackness. Consciousness returned slowly. At first, he was aware of something soft under his head. For the moment, that was enough, and he lay motionless, while pain flowed in again across his chest and side. Finally, as the sharpening pain prodded him awake, he was able to open his eyes. It must be night. He could see nothing in the blackness. Then he realized that someone was bending over him, and gropingly, he made out a woman's head with dark masses of hair, her face a white blur in the dimness. Then he remembered and struggled to move. Instantly, the sick blackness roared over him. After a time, it all started over again. The pain, the groping, the face of the girl still looking down at him.
"Where am I?"
he asked carefully, not moving.
"Hush," Malthace whispered. "Don't speak out loud. You're in a storage room."
The words reached him from a great distance. He lay trying to grasp their meaning.
"Daniel," she whispered again, "can you hear me?"
"Yes."
"I'm going to go and get something for your wound. Just lie still and don't make any noise. I'll come as soon as I can. Do you understand?"
"Yes." There was a rustling and a streak of light, then blackness again. He understood only that she had gone and that he did not need to move. After a time, the streak of light fell across him again. The girl was bending over him once more.
"Are you awake?"
she whispered.
"Here, drink this. I'll hold it for you."
The cool rim of a cup touched his lips. A gentle hand lifted his head. The wine was strong, with an unfamiliar bitter taste. It spread warmly down his throat, into his chest, pushing back the pain. She set down the cup.
"Now I have to pull away this cloth. I'll try not to hurt you."
He clenched his teeth while she slowly eased the blood-stiffened tunic from his ribs. The wine made his head swim. He suspected there must have been medicine in it. He was aware that she was sponging his side, and he smelled the pungent odor of dill and the sweetish fragrance of oil, and felt a soft, dry cloth against his side.
"How did I get here?" he murmured. "I dragged you in. Why didn't you tell me you were hurt? You all would never have forgiven me if anything."
She fell silent, bound the cloth snugly against him, and held the wine again to his lips.
"I can't stay any longer," she said then. "Yuel will be here soon, and he'll know what to do. Don't move. Just wait till we come."
He did not know how long he waited, drifting in a sluggish river. Finally, the crack of light appeared, widened, and when it closed, there was still light. Yuel had brought a candle, the flame lighting up his worried face.
"Daniel, are you all right? Thank God you came here."
"I didn't know where,"
Daniel began.
"Don't talk. I heard what happened. They're searching all over town. When Thace told me, I knew it must have been you."
"You were crazy, Daniel."
"Don't make him talk, Yoel." Malthace was close behind.
"See, Daniel, I've brought some gruel for you. Can you eat a little?"
Yoel held the candle while the girl dipped up spoonfuls of gruel. It tasted warm and good, but the effort was too great. After 3 attempts, he had to close his eyes and rest. Presently, he forced himself to speak again.
"I have put your house in danger."
"No. They'll never think of searching Father's house. Let me look at that wound, Daniel." Yoel knelt down and cautiously pulled away the bandage. He let out a slow whistle.
"You're lucky. Another inch or so. There's a nasty hole.
No use arguing. You'll have to stay quiet." Daniel did not attempt to argue. He knew he could not even get to his feet.
"I don't think this place is safe,"
Yoel went on. "One of the slaves might come to get grain any moment. There's a passage between the two walls. Thace and I discovered it when we were children visiting here. If we lift you onto a mat and drag you, can you stand it?"
"Yes,"
he said. He could stand anything in his helpless gratitude. The passage was scarcely 2 cubits wide. Yoel, stooping over and tugging, with Thacia steadying behind, made slow progress, bumping along the rough earth floor for some distance before Yoel was satisfied. Then he smoothed the mat carefully while Thacia went back to get grain sacks for a pillow and covering. "I hate to leave you in this place," Yoel said, shining the candle beam along the box-like walls. "It's not too airy, but you won't suffocate, and I'm sure no one will find you." Daniel tried to stammer his thanks. "I wish I could do more," Yoel answered. "I'm sorry things went wrong at dinner today. Father isn't like that, really. It's just that he's suspected for a long time how I feel, and he's afraid I'll join the Zealots." "I talked like a fool," Daniel said. "Well, yes, you did." Yoel smiled for the first time. "But I wish I had the courage to stand up to him like that."
"If he finds out,
he'd never give you away. I'm sure of that. But he would start asking questions about Amalek and the mountain and all. No knowing where it would end. Just stay here and don't worry about it. Thace and I will come whenever we can." Thacia murmured something to her brother. "Yes, we have to go," Yoel answered. "Will you be all right alone here, Daniel?"
"Yes,"
said Daniel.
Sleep all you can. I'll be back."
He lay still while the candlelight and the footsteps receded. Just before the blackness closed down, he thought he heard a whispered voice. "Good night, Daniel." He was not sure, and as the fever began to rise in him, he imagined that it had been his mother's voice, speaking the words he had not heard for years.
7. The Bronze Bow.
"And the kings and the mighty and exalted and those who rule the earth shall fall before him on their faces."
Yoel's voice, hardly more than a whisper, trembled with earnestness as he read. He sat on the dirt floor of the passage, stooping to hold the scroll so that it caught the light from the one sputtering wick they dared to burn. His two listeners sat motionless against the wall, scarcely breathing, held by the music of the words and the spell of the ancient prophecy.
"And their faces shall be filled with shame, and the darkness shall grow deeper on their faces, and he will deliver them to the angels for punishment, to execute vengeance on them, because they have oppressed his children and his elect. The elect shall rejoice over them, because the wrath of the Lord of Spirits resteth upon them, and his sword is drunk with their blood."
Daniel leaned back, his face hidden in the shadows. The words were like the wine that Thacia brought to him every evening. He could feel them like fire in his veins. And tonight, for the first time, he was conscious of his own strength stirring within him. 5 days and nights he had spent in this narrow passage, while the fever burned itself out and the pain in his side gradually eased. Soon now he must leave this place, and he must store up these words to take back with him to the cave. Yoel came to the end of the scroll. For a moment, there was not a sound. Then Yoel began to roll the papyrus carefully, and the girl beside him let out her breath in a long sigh.
"Yoel," she said thoughtfully, "has Father read the Book of Enoch?"
"Of course he has."
"Then why does he say that the Jews must not fight for their freedom?"
"Father believes we must leave the future to God, that when God is ready, he will establish his kingdom on earth."
"Don't you believe that too, Yoel?"
Yoel's eyebrows drew together.
"In a way, I do," he said. "But the men of old didn't wait for God to win their battles for them. They rose up and fought, and God strengthened them. Maybe God is waiting for us now. It seems to me we've tried Father's way long enough. What do you say, Daniel?"
Daniel had been content just to listen. He envied Yoel the ability to find so readily the right words. He scowled now with the effort to make them understand his thoughts.
"We've waited too long," he said. "This Phinehas, the one you read about last night, he pulled out his sword and killed the enemies of God, and God rewarded him for it.
When will God send us another Phinehas?
Yoel sighed.
Suppose he did.
Daniel burst out, ignoring the stab of pain in his side.
One man is not enough. What could he do without an army? Without men, thousands of men, and weapons to fight with? Why aren't we making ready?
Isn't that what Rosh is doing up on the mountain?
Yes, but Rosh can't do it alone. There are only a few of us.
Daniel. Yoel leaned forward, his eyes wide with sudden awe. His breath caught so that the words would scarcely come.
Did you ever think that Rosh, that he might be the leader we are waiting for?
It was out at last, the thought that neither of them had dared admit to the other.
I know he is, said Daniel.
They sat silent, trembling at the immensity of the secret they shared.
He's like a lion,
Daniel said, his confidence mounting. He has no fear at all. Up there in the cave, whatever he says, the men obey him without question. If there were more of us, if we could only get enough, Rosh would drive every cursed Roman back into the sea.
Before Yoel could speak, Malthus interrupted.
But this Rosh is an outlaw,
she protested.
Surely God would not choose a man like that to bring in his kingdom.
Daniel bristled. He could not make this girl out. Was she for him or against him?
She had hidden him and dressed his wound and brought him food. But before that, she had pleaded with him to leave Yoel alone. She had done all this for her brother. But wouldn't she still fight to keep Yoel in a safe world?
What difference does it make what Rosh is? He demanded.
If he can rid us of the Romans, the kingdom can take care of itself.
But it is the same thing, said Yoel. Victory and the kingdom.
Call it what you like, Daniel said impatiently. All I know is I hate the Romans. I want their blood. That is what I live for. It's all I've lived for since...
Since what, Daniel?
Yoel urged.
Since they killed my father and mother.
There was a silence, and then Malthus said, very gently,
Tell us, Daniel.
Daniel wavered. He was torn, as he had been torn that first day on the mountain, between the desire to stay in hiding and the need to speak to them. No one in the cave knew all of his story. He never spoke of it. He dreaded to bring it up out of the secret places of his memory. But even more, he longed to share the burden that he had carried alone for so many years.
It's not a good story for a girl to hear, he said.
Is it about your mother?
Asked Malthus.
About them both.
If it's about my own people, about another woman like myself, then I can hear it.
Daniel stared at the blur of her face against the wall. Her eyes shone deep and steady. Was she for him or against him? He began to grope his way back, far back to the beginning.
It was when I was 8 years old, he told them. I was in the synagogue school then. My father was overseer of the vineyards. It was a good job. I don't remember ever being hungry or afraid. He used to tell us stories after the evening meal. He knew them all by heart. My sister was only 5. She had yellow hair and blue eyes like our mother. That's because my mother's mother was a Greek slave who married her Jewish master. But my mother never knew any foreign ways. She believed in the God of the Jews. She taught us verses from the scripture and made us say them after her. I think we were like all the other families. Perhaps it is still like that, in the houses in the village.
Yoel nodded.
It was so in our house, he said. My father had a brother, younger than he was, and they were very close. When I was very young, my uncle lived in our house with us, but then he married and went to live in a house of his own not far away. I can remember the wedding. That let me walk in the procession, and I was so excited that I dropped my torch and burned a hole in my new coat.
Daniel stopped and waited for a moment. This part, the good part,
had been buried very deep. The others did not speak, letting him find his difficult way back at his own halting pace. My uncle was so proud of his wife. When their first baby was born, a boy, you would have thought no one ever had had a son before. He did a very foolish thing. It was almost time for the taxes, and he took part of the money he had saved and bought his wife a present, a shawl with gold thread in it for her to wear to the naming. He planned to find extra work and make up the money. But that year, the Romans were building a new section of road, and the collector came early. My uncle should have come to my father, but he was ashamed, because of course none of us ever had money to spare. So he tried to argue that it was not time. He was a very excitable man, and the collector was angry and reported him. The soldiers came and put him in the guardhouse. As soon as my father heard, he went to all his friends and collected enough money for the tax. But my uncle had lost his head and tried to fight his way out, and the soldiers would not let him off. They said he would go to the quarries to work off his debt. We all knew they would never let him go, or that he would fight them and get killed. His wife was almost out of her mind. She came and put her arms around my father's knees and screamed at him. So my father made a plan. He was a peaceful man, but he armed himself. He and four others hid in a cornfield and waited till the Romans started for the city with my uncle. And then they attacked. Of course, they were all captured. One of the soldiers was cut with a sickle, and he died that night. They wanted to make an example for the village. They crucified all six of them, even my uncle, who had not done anything because his hands were tied behind him. There was a sound like a moan from Thasia. Yoel did not move. After a moment, Daniel went on. My mother stood out by the crosses all day and all night for 2 days. It was cold and foggy at night, and when she finally came home, she did nothing but cough and cry. She only lived a few weeks. "Were you there too?" asked Thasia under her breath. "Yes, I was there. After my father died, I made a vow. Maybe they would say a boy 8 years old couldn't make a vow, a real one that was binding. But I did. I vowed I would pay them back with my whole life, that I would hate them and fight them and kill them. That's all I live for." When he stopped speaking, he realized that he was trembling all over, and the wretched cold sickness was climbing up into his throat. He wished they would go away now and leave him alone, but Thasia questioned him again. "Who took care of you after that?" "My grandmother. She made me go to school for 5 years. But then she was ill, and there wasn't enough to eat, and she sold me to a Moloch."
"What about your sister?"
Daniel hesitated. "Yes, they had to know this, too. I told you she was only 5. That night she got away from a neighbor and ran out. They didn't know how long she had been there by the crosses before they found her and took her back. She used to scream in her sleep. Then she refused to go out of the house. If we tried to make her, she would howl till she was blue and fall into a sort of fit, and we would think she was dead, and then she would be ill for days. So we gave up. She has always been sickly. She doesn't eat enough. I think she has forgotten everything, but the demons will not leave her. She has never gone out of the house." He stopped, helpless in his longing to make them understand Leia. "She is very gentle and good," he added, looking humbly at Malthace. To his surprise, her eyes glistened with tears. He had to look away. Since the beginning of Daniel's story, Yoel had not spoken a word. He sat now staring straight ahead of him. Somehow, in a few moments, he had grown older. The man he would become was revealed in his young face. All at once, he came up to his knees and knelt in the narrow space, his shoulders taut. Daniel saw that his lips were trembling. "Daniel," he choked, "I will take the oath too. Before heaven, I will avenge your father. I swear it. I will fight them as long as I live." Swept up by the boy's passion, Daniel was checked by a sudden stab of guilt. He had not intended this. Was it fair to win Yoel in this way?
No, he exclaimed. No, Yoel, it is not your quarrel.
But it is, cried Yoel. Mine and every other Jew's. Your father is only one out of thousands who have died at their hands. We must do anything, anything, to make the country free again.
It was what he had wanted, what he had come to Capernaum to accomplish. But he was not sure. To drag Yoel out of his safe scholar's life, into the dark danger of his own world? Thashia understood. After one gasp of dismay, she sat huddled against the wall, staring at her brother with terror in her eyes. But behind the terror, there was pride. Yoel turned to her.
You see it has to be this way, don't you, Thais? I can't go on burying my head in a book while things like this are happening. You must see it. We've always seen things the same way.
Thashia looked back at him, struggling against her fear, and there flashed across to Daniel something of what it must mean to be a twin. Then she drew a long breath.
Yes, she said steadily. I do see. If I were a boy, I would make a vow too.
Suddenly, Yoel's fire leaped up in her face.
Why can't I? She cried. Why can't a girl serve Israel too? What about Deborah and Queen Esther? Let me swear it too, Yoel. I promise to help you.
Jealousy beat suddenly up in Daniel. No, he exploded. This is a man's vow. It's not for a pretty child. Her face went white. At the hurt in it, Daniel cursed himself. What had made him say a thing like that to her? But this time, Yoel came instantly to his sister's support.
Then we will make a new vow, he said. The three of us together. We'll swear to fight for Israel. For...
He hesitated.
For God's victory, said Thashia swiftly. Remember the watchword of the Maccabees?
Yes, that's it.
Come swear it together, now, on the Book of Enoch here. What could be better? Put your hands on mine, both of you. Swear to stand together, the three of us, for God's victory.
Thashia laid her hand firmly over her brother's.
For God's victory, she repeated.
They looked at Daniel, waiting. The three of us, Yoel had said, taking him, who had always stood outside, into the close circle of their lives. With an effort, he leaned over and laid his hand over the girl's. He felt the small, fine bones under his palm.
For God's victory, he choked.
He drew back quickly into the shadow, afraid for them to see his face. But they were far too lost in their own excitement to notice his.
Now we must plan what to do, said Yoel solemnly. Tomorrow night, I'll bring...
Oh, Thashia remembered. Tomorrow night will be the Sabbath.
Yoel considered.
We can come anyway, he decided. The law doesn't forbid visiting the sick.
We can't unbind the wound or put on a fresh dressing.
No matter, put in Daniel. The wound is almost healed.
I'll bring the food before sunset, Thashia promised. Enough to last through the Sabbath.
We must plan, Yoel went on, still lost in the wonder of his new resolve.
When you go back to the mountain, I'm going with you.
No, objected Daniel. That's not what Rosh wants of you. He wants a man here in Capernaum. Right now it's better for you to stay in school.
He could see that in spite of his vow, Yoel was relieved.
I'm willing to give up school, Yoel insisted.
I mean it. I'll do anything.
Stay in school then. We're not ready to fight yet. We've got to wait and work for it.
Rosh has something in mind for you. I don't know what it is, but he'll send you word.
You're sure?
Yes, you can count on it.
I've been thinking of a plan, Yoel said. If you should bring a message from Rosh, or if you should ever need to get away from the Romans again, there's an opening in the outside wall, at the angle where this passage joins the storage room. It's used to bring the sacks of grain in from the street. And it's just big enough for a man to crawl through.
I tried it. I'll make sure it's kept unlatched, and you can push it open. That way, no one will ever suspect you're here.
How will you know it? Daniel asked.
I thought of that. If you could mark some sign on the wall.
A bow!
Thashia exclaimed.
You know, from the Song of David you read last night.
The bronze bow, Daniel exclaimed, pleased that Thashia too had remembered.
Will you read that part again, Yoel?
I didn't bring the scroll, Yoel said, but I know it by heart. He leaned back against the wall.
God is my strong refuge and has made my way safe. He made my feet like hinds' feet and set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze.
It couldn't really be bronze, said Daniel, puzzled.
The strongest man could not bend a bow of bronze.
Perhaps just the tips were metal, Yoel suggested.
No,
Thashia spoke.
I think it was really bronze. I think David meant a bow that a man couldn't bend, that when God strengthens us, we can do something that seems impossible.
Perhaps, said Yoel. You do have an imagination, Thace. He went on with the Song of David.
Thou hast given me the shield of thy salvation. Oh, dear,
Thashia broke in, dismayed.
I just remembered. Father asked me to play for his guests tonight.
Then we must go, said Yoel quickly, gathering up the scroll of Enoch. Father likes to have Thace play the harp for him, he explained, seeing Daniel's bewilderment. Daniel looked at Thashia.
I have never heard a harp, he said.
Then I'll bring it and play for you tomorrow, she promised.
No, not on the Sabbath,
but I won't forget. Do you want us to leave the light, Daniel?
No,
said Daniel. I'm used to the dark. They crept along the passage, the light flickering and vanishing altogether. Then, very faintly, came the whispered words,
Good night, Daniel.
This time, he was certain he had heard them. He lay in the darkness, and it seemed that a warmth and light still glowed all around him. Together, Yoel had said. Three of us together, and Thashia was not against him.
He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze.
He could see the shining bow, the bow that no man could bend with his own strength alone. Suddenly, he sat up. It came to him that Yoel had given him the answer to his most urgent question. It was time for him to leave this place. For 2 days, without their knowing, he had tested his strength, pacing back and forth in the narrow passage. Yoel would try to keep him. Better simply to go. They would be horrified that he had chosen the Sabbath, when a man could walk no more than 2,000 cubits from his home. But the law was for the wealthy, for the scholars, not for the poor. By now, he had broken so many points of the law that he was beyond all redemption. What matter if he broke one more? Toward morning, when he was sure that all the household would be asleep, he crawled along the passage. His fingers discovered a latch, and the little service door swung inward. He eased himself through the narrow slot, into the street, pulled himself to his feet, and made his way through the city toward the mountain.
I would like to have heard that harp, he thought once.
But he put that behind him. Instead, he repeated the Song of David. He has made my feet like hinds' feet and set me secure on the heights. All the same, he would like to know how a harp sounded.
8. The Bronze Bow.
Daniel had overestimated his strength. Long before he reached the mountain, he knew that he had left the shelter of Yoel's passageway too soon. Toiling uphill under a merciless sun, he had to stop so often that it was late afternoon before he came to the steep zigzag rise up the cliff. He was not sure he could make it. Suddenly, it seemed to his wavering sight that one of the dark boulders high on the cliff detached itself from the rest and rolled toward him. Samson came leaping down the trail to kneel at his feet. Then, when Daniel tried to speak and no sound would come, the big man rose swiftly, lifted the boy in his great arms, and carried him gently up the trail to the cave. Samson did not allow Daniel to get on his feet again for 3 days. Like a vast shadow, he sheltered him. He brought water mixed with wine, in which he steeped roots of the mountain lilies. He snatched the choicest bits of roasting game from beneath the very nose of Rosh to feed his patient. Daniel noticed that the men were getting accustomed to Samson and treated him with better humor, though none of them ever disputed him. As for himself, Daniel had acquired new status. By the unfailing grapevine, word of his exploit in the town had reached the cave days before. They had all given him up, believing him dead or captured. Some of the men admired his nerve. Others were relieved to have him in charge of Samson again. For a day or so, they made a hero of him, and then they forgot the matter and ignored him, and life in the cave went on exactly as before. For Daniel, nothing could ever be the same. He had never admitted to himself that he was lonely here on the mountain. He had worshipped and feared Rosh. He had fought and eaten and slept side by side with the hard-eyed men who made up Rosh's band. But the few days in Yoel's passageway had shown him a new world. He had found someone to talk to, someone who had shared his own thoughts, and who had instantly taken Daniel's burden as his own. The memory of the pact they had made glowed like a warm coal in the heart of the forge. Lying in the sunlight, his back against the baked gray rock, Daniel repeated to himself the chronicles that Yoel had read aloud. The glorious deeds of Joshua, of Phinehas, Saul, and David. Most of all, he thought of Judas Maccabeus, who had given them a watchword. The other mighty ones had lived and fought in distant ages. But Judas had lived in a time like his own, not 200 years ago, when Israel was helpless, as it was now, under the foot of the heathen. Judas, with his heroic father and brothers, had dared to rise up and defy the oppressor, and for a time, Israel had breathed the free air again. Here in these very mountains, Judas, young and daring and cunning as a panther, had hidden from his enemies and taken them by surprise. Many brave men had joyfully laid down their lives for Judas, but never enough, never quite enough. This time, there were young men everywhere who longed for such a chance again. Together, he and Yoel would find them. The third member of the pact? He was not sure about Thashia. In all his life, he had known only two girls, and he did not understand them. Compared to his own sister, Thashia was like a brilliant scarlet lily, glowing and proud. He could count on her loyalty to Yoel. In all else, she was unpredictable. The very thought of her was disturbing. He tried to shut her out of his mind, as he tried to shut out the thought of Leia. Both girls, so utterly unlike, seemed in some way to threaten his plans. The prospect of seeing Yoel again occupied all his thoughts, and the opportunity came unexpectedly soon. A week after he was brought back at the forge, doing the light work that Samson allowed him, Rosh brought him a dagger to mend. It was a special dagger that Rosh had carried for years as a talisman, and some mischance had sent it hurling down a chasm. 5 men had been sent to retrieve it. 4 had come back empty-handed, but hours later the 5th, exhausted and bleeding, had brought the thing back. Rosh received it with scant gratitude. It was bent askew, twisted out of the shaft, and useless. "Fix it," he demanded of Daniel. Daniel took the blade in his hand. He thought that it might be mended, but he knew that he could not do the job. "I don't have the right tools," he explained. "It needs a new collar and rivet. My forge doesn't give heat enough."
"Then get a rivet."
Daniel looked back at the man. He would think a new dagger would be easier to come by, but he knew that Rosh had attached some sort of luck to this particular blade. "In the city?" he asked.
"Wherever you can find them. This friend of yours, Simone,
He said he was an ironsmith. Get them from him.
Daniel remembered that Simone and Roche did not see eye to eye.
You mean I should buy them from Simone?
Buy? He is a zealot. He can give a scrap of metal for the cause.
Daniel woke next morning hoping that Roche had forgotten, but he saw at once that the leader was more determined than ever. He gave Daniel no money. All the way to the village, Daniel tried to think of an argument that would convince Simone. The metal parts that he needed were costly. Roche seemed to think he could snatch them as he might a squash from a village garden. It occurred to him that perhaps, unknown to Roche, he could offer to do a day's work in Simone's shop. The smithy was closed, a bar and padlock across the door. Strange, for if Simone had gone off about the village to fix a lock or repair a plow, he would have left the shop open to customers. Daniel sat down on the stone doorstep to wait. After a time, he felt uneasy. The unoccupied feel of the place grew on him, and he was not surprised when a passing villager called out to him.
If you're waiting for the smith, you'll have a long wait. Shop hasn't been open for a month.
Where is Simone?
Daniel called back.
Left town. Heard he went after a preacher, one who came through here a while back. There's a new smith in Corazin, if you want some work done.
Gone after a preacher.
All at once, Daniel remembered the Sabbath morning and the strange look in Simone's eyes.
I don't know what he means, Simone had said, but I intend to find out.
What could Simone have found that would keep him for a month? Daniel had not lived with Roche for 5 years without learning that there was no use going back without the rivet. He knew well enough, too, what Roche would expect. But Simone had been good to him. He refused to break into Simone's shop and help himself. There was nothing to do but find Simone, and with the thought, he knew a deep satisfaction. He knew that all along he had hoped for an excuse to go to Capernaum. Would he be recognized in the city? Daniel thought not. He had a hunch about Romans. To him, every stupid Roman face looked alike. He had an idea that to the Romans, every Jew would look alike too. He was sure they seldom bent their stiff necks to take a good look at one. There was little likelihood that the soldier on horseback would remember the boy at the well. At any rate, it was worth the chance. He got to his feet and set out for Capernaum. He reached the city in the early afternoon and made his way straight to the harbor. If anyone